Hello everyone, it's Margaret Ake here. Welcome to the NT Pod, the podcast all about the New Testament and Christian origins. It's episode 115, and today I'm in conversation with Dr. Ian Mills. Ian Mills is a research fellow at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at Australian Catholic University. He completed his PhD at Duke University in 2021, and his latest book is called The Hypothesis of the Gospels, Narrative Traditions in Hellenistic Reading Culture. It was published at the end of 2025 by Fortress Press, and he's also the co-host of the NT Review podcast, which some of you might know. Absolute pleasure to sit down with Ian and have this conversation all about his research. Well, it's a great pleasure today to welcome to the NT Pod Dr. Ian Mills. Dr. Ian Mills is Visiting Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies at Hamilton College. He's also a former Duke University PhD student. He worked with me. It was great. He was great. And some of the work that he did back then as a PhD student is now been crystallized, revised, and I don't know how to put it, rewritten in this excellent new book called The Hypothesis of the Gospels, which I've invited Ian to talk about on the podcast today. Very warm welcome to the NT Pod, Ian.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Mark. This is pretty clearly just academic nepotism, and I
Absolutely, yeah, it absolutely is. But I will say that I'm not the only person that's written a glowing endorsement on this book. I thought my endorsement was pretty glowing, but I will say that I'm not the only person that's written a glowing endorsement of this book. Above mine appears one from a certain Bart D. Ehrman, and it says, "You can read hundreds of books on the Gospels and find little, new, and nothing groundbreaking. This book is groundbreaking." I think that's such a great endorsement. So,
Ian, made my day when I got that one.
It's great, isn't it? So Ian, tell us about the hypothesis of the Gospels. What is it?
Yeah, thanks so much. So this book is not my dissertation. This is a book that this is an idea I came across while I was writing my dissertation and ended up, you know, playing into it. But I actually set out to write an article about books that shared a title in, let's say, the first and second century. That was the sort of goal. And so I went and started collecting examples of what books were there published in the centuries around the Gospels that all shared the same title. Because I was kind of thinking at the time about Gospel titles, which is a chapter that actually ended up getting cut from this book project that'll show up another time. And in doing that, I kept running across the same word, hypothesis, that was showing up over and over again when authors in antiquity were talking about books with the same title. And I found that, like, English translators were sometimes just, like, completely skipping this word, or were using all sorts of different kinds of translations. It wasn't translating nicely into English. And I thought, that is interesting, especially since this word was used to sort of describe what it meant to write within a literary tradition, within a narrative tradition. Over and over, we find that people said, so one of the first examples that I really came across was Dio Chrysostom discussing the three Philoctetes. So Dio Chrysostom is writing end of the first, beginning of the second century, and he sets out to read. He says one morning he woke up sick and set out to read three plays by the same title, the Philoctetes by Aeschylus, Euripides, and Sophocles. And right at the beginning, he says, you know, these works differ in all these ways, and he does a sort of comparison and contrast. He does what we would call redaction criticism, and, you know, what motivated one author to write another way. But what they share is a hypothesis. And I thought, that's interesting. And then I started reading widely, looking for this word hypothesis, and one really rich store of resources I found are the scholia. So I place a real big emphasis on these Homeric and dramatic scholia throughout the book, which are sort of readers, well, they're excerpts from previous scholarship, usually from previous commentaries and treatises that readers have copied in usually into the margins or used in their own commentaries on dramatic plays, on Homeric literature. And what I found is that this term hypothesis is showing up not only just to describe literature, but to evaluate differences between different versions of the same story.
Fantastic. And okay, I remember when you first brought this idea to our graduate seminar at Duke University. And I felt a bit guilty still about this reaction, but there was this sort of mass of puzzled faces around the table. What is he talking about? You know, so I do want to congratulate you for, and this goes to Bart Ehrman's comment, Bart Ehrman's endorsement. I had never heard of this before, and I've read Irenaeus. You know, you do a lengthy discussion of how he uses the term. I must have just skated over it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, and I think, and so I want just for a moment, I want to ask you what this book is not about. Now, when lots of people hear the term "the hypothesis of the Gospels," they're straight away going to think you're talking about, I don't know, the Farah hypothesis, the Q hypothesis, or the hypothesis of Markham priority, or something along those kind of lines, because that's what we're using all the time. Now, it's not that. Can you explain why it's not that, and why you're using this word hypothesis?
Yeah, thanks. I struggled with this. I have a really long footnote. The very first footnote in the very first chapter is discussing what to do with this word, because this word doesn't mean guess. It doesn't mean theory. I do not have some new novel theory about the relationship of the Gospels, about the historicity of the Gospels, about Jesus. This word, a hypothesis, is used in antiquity in a variety of different ways. We actually have several sources that say, you know, this word is used in a bunch of different ways, and lay out, you know, several different ways the word was already, like, people recognized in the first century this word had a diverse array of uses. And really, our use isn't really among them. It is sometimes used as a sort of, I suppose, a sort of supposition, or like, if we suppose. But anyways, the word itself means something like substrate. Hypo is this under prefix, and thesis is like placement. So it's something like the thing placed underneath. And we see it used in art, and even like in literary discussion, using hypothesis as a metaphor to talk about art, to talk about like the raw material you're working with. And like Philodemus makes this explicit, that the hypothesis, like just like the sculptors, is the raw material that an author begins their work with. So the several authors share this common raw material, and they each work it up in different ways, right? So it means something like substrate, something like, I mean, substance is probably the closest word that is commonly used. Ultimately, I decided to leave the word untranslated, mostly because that's what, if you go read scholarship on literary criticism, or you know, literary theory, rhetorical theory in antiquity, they leave the word untranslated, because there isn't a really good corresponding English word. It's certainly not one we use this way.
I mean, for what it's worth, I'm really pleased you didn't call the book "The Substrate of the Gospels."
Exactly.
Or the substance of the Gospels. You couldn't even, sometimes while I was reading the book, I was thinking that our word story equates to the way that they're sometimes using it, that you know, we talk about people telling the Jesus story, and then we'll talk about John's version of the Jesus story, Matthew's version. I mean, that kind of gets to it, but it's still not quite it, is it?
That's right. Muthos is used sometimes sort of paired with hypothesis with really fine distinctions between the two. So story is a close thing. The thing is, hypothesis had a particular shape. There was this sort of way of imagining what a hypothesis was in antiquity that is more defined than a story is for us. For the for people in antiquity, the hypothesis were the main events, characters, and settings. They talk about how, like, you know, Herodotus doesn't have one hypothesis. Herodotus puts together lots of different hypotheses, whereas Thucydides picked one. There's a sort of, like, this word doesn't just mean subject. It doesn't just mean story. It refers to these sort of key elements, such that people can talk about, like, someone rewrote the same story, but violated the hypothesis. They did something that broke the hypothesis. It's something like essence, really. Like, I think the closest thing, people talk about, like, essence, you know, this movie, this adaptation captured the essence of Dune, right?
Right, got it,
And I think that's good, but if I'd published the essence of the Gospels, people would think I'm doing some sort of, like, normative project, like I'm proposing what really the Gospels are about, and
that's what people
in antiquity were doing, but that's not what I'm doing.
No, of course, In fact, you have a fun reflection at the end of the book. Does our distance from these events make us better at seeing what's going on? And you go, kind of, I don't remember the exact, like, maybe, well, maybe not, you know. And I thought that was a very nice piece of honesty, because the fact that so many scholars have missed this for so many years suggests that we are blinded by our own ways of looking at things.
Yeah.
I mean, Tell us about Irenaeus. How does Irenaeus use? For those who are not familiar, Irenaeus is writing in what, 180 or so. He talks about the four gospels. He really has a four gospel canon. It's our earliest really clear exposition of a fourfold gospel: Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Four corners of the world, four winds, four points on the compass, etc. But how does Irenaeus use this term hypothesis? How does he see the four canonical gospels?
Yeah, so I spend the first chapter laying out how this term is used in the centuries around the composition of the Gospels, in all kinds of literature, right? In plays, in histories, and things like that. And I conclude by saying, but we don't, like, it seems really plausible. It seems like really obvious that people, readers of the Gospels, should have used these categories to talk about the Gospels. And we don't have to wonder if they did, because the first author, Irenaeus, who, like, spends any time reflecting on the multiplicity of Gospels, uses this term a whole ton. Only person who uses it more is Epiphanius. He uses this this word a lot. But it's important to notice that Irenaeus's whole move about the fourfold gospel, there is four and only four, that's different. That's a sort of innovation, I argue. And it's an innovation that actually stands somewhat at odds with the sort of standard way of thinking about the hypothesis of narrative traditions. So Irenaeus uses it in a bunch of ways. And I start by just showing, like, clearly Irenaeus is thinking with the same terms. Because one of the first and clearest way he uses this is he's actually comparing the Valentinians, some of his opponents, to ancient playwrights. And he says, just like the ancient playwrights steal their hypotheses, so too the Valentinians stole a hypothesis from the pagans, right? And so they've taken this hypothesis from the pagans and used it to read the Gospels and are reading it into the Gospels. He's in this weird position with the Valentinians where they have all the same books, but they're reading like a fundamentally different story out of it. And he uses the he explicitly invokes the exact same sort of literary conversations, the conversations about the rewriting of stories by tragedians to just describe what's going on with Valentinians. So, like, clearly, Irenaeus is thinking this term the same way. And it's worth noting that while there isn't a lot of scholarship on Gospels and hypothesis stuff, scholars have written about Irenaeus's use of rhetorical and literary critical vocabulary. And I'm certainly not the first person to note that hypothesis is a term that Irenaeus is drawing on Hellenistic scholarship for. So people have noticed this about Irenaeus before. Go ahead.
Does Irenaeus therefore have a bit of a problem in the sense that he uses this well-known terminology, these well-known concepts, but at the same time, he's got this very strict idea, four and only four. I like it is in a way, I assume that when we're looking at this term hypothesis, it's frequently used of there can be multiple versions of the same thing. And Irenaeus is saying, no, it's just the four. So has he got his work cut out for him?
Well, actually, the term is really useful for him just because previous scholars, or, you know, contemporary scholars for Irenaeus, are using this term both to legitimize pluriformity, to say, you know, these two authors differ, but they both preserve the same hypothesis, and to limit pluriformity. Hellenistic scholars all the time are saying, you know, this story can't be told this way. This change that Euripides makes is actually bad because it breaks the hypothesis, because it hurts the hypothesis. And so Irenaeus, in most of Against Heresies, I think for most of books 1 through 3, actually finds this term really useful. He can accuse people like Marcion of really not getting the hypothesis. And he can say, people who just pick one gospel are wrong because each gospel, you know, individually, he says at one place, each gospel individually and equally preserves the hypothesis. A really nice sort of full classical statement of what people say about the hypothesis. Each of the four do, and the other gospels don't, is basically his point. We have to talk a little bit about his use of the word gospel all by itself as a substitute for hypothesis, but, like, let's just put that aside for a second.
Sure.
But that is a problem because he wants to do something else, which is he wants to say later, in just like two small sections of Irenaeus that are right next to each other, he wants to say, but you have to have four and exactly four. And that actually isn't compatible with what he said earlier about each gospel individually and equally doing it. He seems to sort of have this, he uses hypothesis and it's useful for him when he's treating gospels like other narrative traditions. But when he wants to do this really unique thing, it does stand somewhat in tension with hypothesis. And I think we see that again over and over as I go through church history, Christian history, that when people stop treating the gospels like normal books, like Origen is the big example I point to, hypothesis rhetoric is actually, or language or the idea, isn't as useful to them.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about how he uses the word gospel then, because that's the thing that most people will be familiar with in Irenaeus. Like when I do a course on, you know, every year, every single time I teach New Testament or Jesus and the Gospels, you know, we do a whole thing on canon. I used to find it the most boring lecture of all until I realized that I was just thinking about the whole thing incorrectly. Actually, canon is fascinating as a thing. But whenever we do that, I whack on the handout, Irenaeus talking about the Gospels. And that term gospel, you know, it seems to be so already like embedded in the way that people are conceptualizing these works. And you know, and none of them actually, at least in the text of themselves, I mean, they have these big titles, the Gospel According To, but in the text themselves, I mean, Mark has got the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, but none of the others, you know, begin, this is the Gospel of, you know. Right. So tell us about how Irenaeus uses the word. And is he innovating, or is it that already something that is embedded in his own tradition?
Yeah, so a tiny piece of background here, which is that we often find in Hellenistic literary criticism authors using the title of a particularly important work as a shorthand for the hypothesis. So you'll find two parallel passages that are saying the exact same thing, and one will say that both Xenophon and Plato Xenophon and Plato wrote their apologies on the same hypothesis, wrote their symposia on the same hypothesis, and then another author, or even the same author in a different place, will say they both wrote an apology. They both wrote a symposium. One example I point out is like talking about all these different authors who wrote an Iliad, and the same author will say in one place they wrote an Iliad, or will say they wrote their own stories, often with different titles, on the same hypothesis, both about, you know, the story of the Trojan War. So we see there is a widespread convention of using the title of a particularly important work as a shorthand or substitute to refer to the hypothesis. And I argue Irenaeus does the same thing. And to do this, I mean, what really brought this to light for me, what really, you know, made this chapter make sense for me, is actually a piece written by Annette Yashica Reed on the use of the gospel in Irenaeus. And rightly, she points out that Irenaeus uses this term in the sort of kerygmatic or preaching sense, right? The message that Christians share, the message that Paul preached. Obviously, Irenaeus uses the term that way, just as all other Christian authors do. And it clearly has a bibliographic use of this. You can read in the gospel, right? The gospel according to Matthew. You've got this sort of clear bibliographic use. And I think, I mean, I show this evidence later in my book, but like Irenaeus is inheriting that. Justin already has gospels and the gospel, even though that's not his preferred term. He says everyone else calls these gospels in the Bible. And there's a bunch of people from the first half of the second century, the Epistle Apostolorum, like this bibliographic use is well established. But the thing that Professor Reed pointed out that was really striking is that there's a third use in Irenaeus. And this third use, she says, stands somewhere between the two, or is sort of a tertium quid. It's this use to refer to the literary tradition of the Gospels, but only the ones that Irenaeus says count. And I read that and I'm like, that's the hypothesis. Like, that is exactly how other people are using this, using a title as a shorthand for hypothesis. And we can see Irenaeus like does this. He will switch between talking about the true hypothesis, the hypothesis of God, the hypothesis of the Lord, and the gospel. Passage by passage, he'll switch between these, or he'll juxtapose the Valentinian hypothesis with the gospel. So he's clearly using these words interchangeably.
Yeah.
And then as he gets later and gets more into his, you know, in book three, and he gets to these classic fourfold things, hypothesis actually sort of fades out, and the gospel just becomes his sort of, that's the word he uses.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, does that make your work quite conservative, in the sense that we're actually regaining these works as being the gospel according to? In other words, when we see, we always explain to our students, look, you know, when whoever wrote Matthew's gospel wrote Matthew's gospel, he didn't sit down and begin title the gospel according to Saint Matthew. There's no way any of them wrote
exactly
that. But it does mean that if you're right, and I think you are, it does mean that if you're right, that way of looking at the Gospels, that very early piece of reception history of the Gospels, actually represents quite accurately how people first read them. They read them as, this is the Gospel, the hypothesis, according to Matthew, according to Mark, according to Luke. Is there something in that?
That's the chapter I cut. and we'll probably end up as a separate article. But it's precisely this, that the what is going on with this kata, this according to formula, what is the sort of shared thing according to these four different people? What is this word gospel? And you know, there are scholars who've argued that gospel, you know, these aren't actually different books. They're four manuscript traditions of the same book. And I think that's just like plainly wrong on all sorts of counts, especially because the very people who are using that language think of these as books that are authored independently in different settings, which, you know, I don't actually believe that. I think that the authors were using each other, but like the people using this language don't think about books that way. What I think that gospel that we are is according to so-and-so author is the hypothesis that that use of the word gospel is a hypothetic use of the word gospel. And scholars have long noted that the only other clear use of this kata according to formula, I'm really spoiling my future work here, but is found in medical literature, where writing according to the same hypothesis, writing books on the same title, is rampant. And it's specifically in these contexts where people are writing on, Galen talks about this, using hypothesis language very explicitly, writing books on the same with the same title that are according to the same hypothesis. And it is in those contexts that we see this according to formula being used as the title for gospels. So no, yeah, this actually isn't in the book. This was supposed to be the sixth chapter, but you're exactly right. This is, I'm not sure if that makes me a conservative, but that definitely is what
I'm just mucking about. I mean, it does sort of, I don't know, it gives us a chance to, I don't know, to reclaim that as a really relevant datum. But I mean, what it makes, I mean, one of the things I enjoyed about this book, and we won't be able to sort of cover all of it, I want to encourage people to buy it after all, The Hypothesis of the Gospels, published by Fortress Press. It's not actually, you know, huge in length. It's quite similar in length to the book I've just produced, actually. So I'm thinking, what is it, like 70,000 words, something like that?
Yeah, something in that order. The number.
So I do want to encourage people to go away and buy it and read it. But one of the bits that I found most enlightening is your discussion of some of the other Gospels, Gospel of Thomas, Epistula Apostolorum, Gospel of Peter. I think they're the three that you focus in on. Tell me about what's going on there, because when we read the Gospel of Thomas, you know, we get to the end and this is called the Gospel according to Thomas. So Thomas is very different from the four canonicals. I mean, for those that are not familiar with it, you know, it's not a narrative gospel. It doesn't end with crucifixion and resurrection. It's just basically a bunch of sayings and conversations. So how is that still according to Thomas? How is that still fitting the pattern, or does it diverge from the pattern? How far can you stretch it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question about the title. I'd have to go back and look at who uses of versus the genitive construction versus who uses the kata construction. Actually, Professor Reed has a footnote that's sort of discussing this use and non-use. She suggests that the kata typically is associated with people who are using multiple gospels together, and the genitive construction is often when people are not collecting multiple gospels. Perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, Thomas is definitely kata.
But Thomas works here, because Thomas, as I argue in the book, assumes your knowledge of the other gospels. Cool. And is very explicit about this. Obviously, I'm drawing on some Professor Goodacre's work. But you know, it's very explicit about this. That there's public teaching, and this is the private teaching, right? This is the secret sayings, which I think implies the existence of non-secret sayings. Now I don't do the title work in this book. So let me just say a word, if you don't mind, about what I'm actually doing in that chapter.
Please do. Yeah.
Which is, after going over all the people who explicitly use, not all the people actually, but a selection of the people who explicitly use hypothesis language to theorize the pluriformity of the Gospels, I argue that it's actually plausible, given all of that, to retroject the same sort of what I call the standard model for thinking about pluriform literary traditions. This is the sort of standard way of imagining these kinds of books, to sort of retroject, look at earlier authors who do not have any sustained reflection on the multiplicity of gospels, right? Justin never sits down and writes, tells us how he thinks about the relationship between the gospels. But it's really plausible, given all of that, given that it's used wide, not only by like all the Greek authors who do this, but also up through the patristic tradition, that it's possible to retroject that to earlier authors. But to do that, I need to argue that Irenaeus's basic model, not his fourfold gospel model, but his sort of basic way of thinking about the gospels as basically as distinct books that are sort of quote unquote published or made public in the sort of conventional ways that are thought of as authored texts, that way of imagining gospels that we see so clearly articulated in Irenaeus isn't original, isn't an innovation of his, that goes back earlier. So I'm sort of at the same time doing two things there. I'm trying to show how we can see in Justin's use of the singular word gospel to talk about the literary tradition, in Justin's comparison of the Gospels to the memorabilia or the memoirs of Socrates written by Xenophon and Plato, in that way of talking about and thinking about the Gospels and Serapion's evaluation of Gospels, right? That we can see in that the sort of hypothesis model at work. We can see them thinking with a sort of hypothesis idea, while also arguing that this is really plausible because they thought about Gospels like other books. So what Thomas and, I mean, the Epistle of Apostolorum is a fun one because I think a lot of scholars haven't really spent a lot of time with this text.
No, that's right.
Epistle of Apostolorum is this extremely early text, almost certainly from the first half of the second century because it predicts the end of the world, either at 130 or 150. I forget the exact numbers, but the numbers are different based on your text tradition, but predicts the end of the world like before the middle of the second century. And this text describes gospels as authored by individual describes gospels as books that are published by the disciples. So it describes the way they were made public. They were sort of sent out by disciples to be distributed. That gospels are books that aren't supposed to be, they're supposed to be preserved as written. They're sort of supposed to be, you know, not changed, which is of course, you know, standard rhetoric in not only Hellenistic book culture, but in basically all Jewish and Christian Greek literature, and like Thomas thinks of these as sort of public literature sort of conventional Hellenistic models. I also look at the Protoevangelium of James and talk about how they're explicitly thinking of these things as sort of a subclass of histories, as a, something right. belonging to the historical literature.
I mean, and just to pause on, some viewers won't be familiar with the Epistula Apostolorum. I think you actually use the term the Epistle of the Apostles, which is better.
Yeah.
But it does sound like something from like a Danny Kaye film or something, Epistle of the Apostles. It's a fascinating work. I only really began to come to terms with it when I read Francis Watson's edition of it, which basically makes the text intelligible. So I will recommend that book as well for people to dig into. If we can rewind a little bit further and ask the question, okay, so we know what Irenaeus thought. We've got some inkling of what others later than Irenaeus thought. You have some fascinating discussion about the figures earlier than Irenaeus, but let's rewind all the way to the gospel writers themselves. I am very old fashioned in the sense that I want to know what the author of Matthew's gospel thought he was doing. I want to know what Luke thought he was doing. And what I like about this is you're not afraid to be a little bit old fashioned as well, in the new light of seeing the hypothesis of the Gospels, you're able basically to say, oh, does that help us reconceptualize what the evangelists themselves are doing? So what did they think they were doing?
Yeah, so to be clear, I spend almost this entire book talking about the readers of the Gospels, right? And now I do look at Matthew and Luke as readers of Mark, but I only spend exactly 1.5 pages, I just pulled it back, 1.5 pages with a section titled What They Thought They Were Doing. So I go through it and look at Matthew, who I don't think gives us much to work with in terms of like thinking about the Gospels as written on a common hypothesis, mostly because the author of Matthew doesn't spend any time talking about the multiplicity of Gospels. I do argue that Matthew and Luke and these other non-canonical Gospels sort of, in their sort of passing allusions, references, flickers of awareness of other gospel literature, do give us most of the sort of basic picture. Luke's preface here is extremely helpful and enlightening. where I argue that the Lucan preface, verses 1-4, like other authors, uses the account, this logos, this word account of the story of Jesus, very similarly to hypothesis.
Very similar.
Almost, you could actually substitute out a hypothesis, and it wouldn't really change the meaning of the Lucan preface the way it's read. But yes, I do, in the end, sort of ask the question, like, we rely on inferences to authorial intentions in our everyday life just to get around the world. And so you can't fault readers for wondering, what are people thinking? And I argue, like, it's totally plausible. It is completely plausible. In fact, in the case of Luke, I think even more than plausible. I think it's downright likely that they thought of themselves as an author writing a new work, a new book on an established hypothesis.
Right.
And we know that this hypothesis language is not just the language of readers, that authors use this work themselves, everyone from Josephus to ancient historians, Dionysius of Halicarnassus. I mean, he writes this whole treatise about how historians should, you know, write on the same hypothesis, which is really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So authors use this terminology to think about what they are doing when they're writing. And I think it's really plausible, in fact, more likely than not, that that's what Luke thinks he's doing. And I think it's totally plausible that that's what Matthew thinks they're doing, the author Matthew thinks they're doing, and John as well. And one thing that follows from that is that writing on an established hypothesis is invariably considered a competitive act. It is it is agonistic. It is something you do to improve on your predecessors. Almost always, authors are in some way criticizing the authors who have written on the same hypothesis before them.
Do you like
readers? Go on.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, on that note, do you like that terminology? Chris Keith is fond of it, of talking about competitive textuality. Does your work cohere with that, or your thoughts cohere with that?
I think so. I don't like the term for a number of reasons. But I generally think we're on the same page. Although Keith, I like Keith's work, but Keith is also using that to discuss, like, to paint with too broad of a brush, right? Yeah. Keith is also using that to describe, like, Mark's relationship to the Hebrew Bible, to the Jewish scriptures. Okay. Of course, there's a sort of, like, wrestling of control of meaning going on, and you know, ideas about God going on. So there's lots of ways you can be competitive, and I'm not saying Keith is wrong to describe that as competitive. He can use the word however he wants. But I'm meaning something much more specific.
Sure.
And the kinds of competition we see going on when people choose to write on the same hypothesis as a predecessor is way more specific than Mark writing and invoking Isaiah and telling you how to read Isaiah. Mark is not writing on the same hypothesis as Isaiah. Those are clearly on distinct hypotheses. And I think there's something much closer to a desire to supplant at work in writing on the same hypothesis. And I think we see this quite explicitly with someone like Marcion, where Marcion is, like, physically and literally trying to supplant his predecessors. There's all these Gospels, and he wants his followers to read only the Gospel he composes. Similarly, the Gospel of the Hebrews, according to the Hebrews, that's a whole thing. But the work used by the Ebionites is likewise a sort of harmonization of the Synoptics. It's interweaving the Synoptics into a new narrative Gospel. And we're told by several people in antiquity that the Ebionite Christians who have this Gospel use this Gospel exclusively, despite the fact that it's based on other Gospels. But that isn't the only way you can be competitive. And this is what I talk about in the end of the book, is there's also people talking about, like, it isn't just supplanting. I think the Gospel of John, which we've talked about, is a great example of a work that it is trying to improve upon, trying to change, disagrees with its predecessors. It disagrees with its synoptics. At the same time, it assumes knowledge of the underlying hypothesis, presumably from current and contemporary readers of the Gospels. And so I talk about how, like, readers knew that Some works written on the same hypothesis are intended to prevent you from reading their replacements, and some works written on the same hypothesis expect you to continue to have access to their predecessors. And we see evidence from the second century of Christians taking both views of the canonical Gospels. We see someone who receives John as a competitor and rejects it, and we see people who receive that John and try to integrate it into a larger narrative tradition. Tatian, we can keep talking about examples of this.
I mean, it's interesting. I don't think I'd thought much before about the similarities between, let's say, three that you mentioned there: Marcion's Evangelion, Gospel of the Hebrews, and Tatian's Diatessaron, all in different ways do look like they are attempts at supplanting in spite of their being clearly secondary.
That's right.
I know
that's
people correct. Dispute that with Marcion, but So I mean, that's a fascinating element, isn't it? Because I mean, I must admit, when I look at John's Gospel, when I look at the Gospel of Thomas,
I
do see them as only really working rhetorically if they're presupposing
that
hypothesis. And like John is so if. And this is one of the reasons I find the hypothesis that, used in the other sense, the hypothesis that John is independent, so odd. Because if John is written independently of the others, it's a weird looking gospel.
That's
it's
right.
All out of proportion. It thinks that Jesus is, you know, from Galilee, that he's called Jesus of Nazareth, and yet he's barely ever in Galilee. It makes more sense if he's finding extra space for new material. Just as the Gospel of Thomas says, okay, we've got the public stuff. This is the stuff that he told to, you know, his twin brother, you know.
But think about the works that you put on the two sides there, John and Thomas, and the way they relate to their predecessors, just in terms of rewriting, and Tatian, Marcion, and the Gospel of the Hebrews. They copy verbatim extensive passages,
Matthew,
Luke, and Mark,
as
opposed to John, which doesn't treat the synoptics the same way.
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's a kind of warning to us that we need to be careful of speaking about trajectories, like as if something is on a kind of predetermined course, and that John and Thomas are the only kind of gospels that you could have in developing in the second century, because we have very different attempts in those three.
Right.
Now, that's really fascinating. I look forward to sort of, I don't know, developing thoughts about that some more.
Yeah.
I mean, go for it.
So that's what my next, no, yeah, sorry, but that's what my next.
I was just about to ask you that.
About.
Yeah. So, I mean, I desperately want to think about these things some more. So I'm excited to hear about how you're going to develop this research. I know that you know more than most people put together about Tatian's Diatessaron and others of these texts. So tell us where you're. Are you going to develop the work in this book?
Yeah, so I'm supposed to be finishing up in the next couple months here, submitting my manuscript for Tatian the Syrian, a second century evangelist, published in the Cambridge Elements series with CUP, this is specifically focusing in on Tatian as an example of a what I call a synoptic type gospel, which is specifically a way of differentiating this sort of extensive verbatim copying type way of writing from the sorts of work we see going on in the Gospel of John and the work going on in the Gospel of Thomas and a bunch of other gospels that write in approach their source material in a different way, in a more conventional literary Hellenistic way, and looking at Tatian and where the way he wrote his gospel, likewise Marcion does, likewise the Gospel of according to the Hebrews does, where he drew those conventions from, and specifically trying to place Tatian as a technical author, as an author of a technical treatise, which sounds like subject material, which is a problem. The technical is probably the wrong way to describe this. Something like a textbook or it's a genre of literature that was self-consciously and described as pedagogical in nature, that where it was expected for you to do the kinds of verbatim copying that we see in the gospel tradition. And it's the only kinds of literary authored texts from antiquity where we see the kinds of verbatim reproduction that we see in the gospels. It's the only literature you can take and sort of put in synopsis and see 20 word strings of verbatim agreement throughout the entire text, often everywhere people make substantial additions. And the connection I'm trying to make there is that Tatian is presenting himself the way teachers presented themselves, and is publishing within a sort of explicitly publishing the gospel within an explicitly pedagogical genre. So that's what that book will be arguing.
That's fascinating, and that of course channels some of the insights from your dissertation as well. Viewers won't necessarily know that you have this fascinating explanation of why the synoptics look so similar, and it is know because they are writing this kind of technical literature. Is that right? Also channeling Loveday Alexander, who when reading Loveday Alexander's stuff on Luke's preface, and I was like, really? It's like scientific literature? What's going on with that? And you basically for me helped me to appreciate the work that she'd already done, on that. I mean, that's a great insight. Are you doing more with that insight specifically on the Gospels as I don't know, do we want to say technical literature?
Yeah, I'm probably not going to, and I probably need to use a different word in the book.
Yeah.
But I am, working on a piece right now that I'm hoping to publish, which is a sort of defense of Loveday Alexander against her critics.
Right.
Alexander, if you read classicists on Loveday Alexander who cite her regularly, people who work on technical literature, they think her work is unimpeachable.
Unimpeachable.
It is the definitive work on prefaces in technical literature.
That's great.
And makes a clear cut of case. You read gospel scholars and they're like, what could possibly be the reference of works on medicine, of works on tactics, of works on mechanics? What could possibly be the relevance of those to the gospels? And it's, to be fair, if you read Alexander, she doesn't really answer that. She sort of indicates it probably has something to do with the context in which gospels emerged out of. That's kind of the language she uses. And I think she nods at one point towards sort of probably something to do with pedagogy. And so I'm really taking Loveday Alexander. I understand myself to be taking Loveday Alexander and Heidi Wendt, her book on freelance religious experts in antiquity and how they appropriated the sort of wider, also in some depth to Stowers here, how they appropriated, wider discourses, wider forms and methods of other kinds of teaching, of other kinds of teaching tradition, and sort of adopted those methods and used them. And I'm saying Tatian is a dude who we're told was an expert in the sciences. The only other work we have from him is the sustained critique of Greek learning, including medicine, including pharmacology. He is fighting in the streets with doctors. It is no surprise that someone like Tatian would see Luke and say, this is clearly a technical preface, and would adopt the same sort of pedagogical mode for rewriting the gospel himself. And so that's what the book will argue.
Oh, that's great. I really look forward to it. That's absolutely fascinating. No, this has been really fascinating. Once again, I want to recommend The Hypothesis of the Gospels by Ian Mills. I will use the presenter's privilege of asking you one other question. I recently read with great profit an article that you've written about Marcion as a text critic. And for those that don't have access to the journals, there's also an excellent episode of the podcast, The NT Review, featuring Ian alongside Nate Tilley, who's also a former graduate of the graduate program in religion at Duke University. Just tell us briefly, whet our appetites about Marcion as textual critic. What's going on there?
So Marcion, according to the traditional way of understanding Marcion's relationship to Luke, Marcion takes the Gospel of Luke, removes the first three or so chapters, and goes through and cuts a bunch of little things, little small stories, phrases, and rewrites certain phrases to produce his own gospel that divorces the Gospel of Luke, divorces that portrait of Jesus from the Jewish scriptures, from the creator God, right? That's okay. That's the traditional narrative. And if you read most scholarship on Marcion, I'm sort of bracketing for a second people who would challenge that direction of literary relationship. Most scholarship on Marcion, all the way from Harnack to Judith Liu to Sebastian Mole, just the whole trajectory of mainstream scholarship on Marcion, they'll all say that Tatian here is adopting the methods of Hellenistic textual criticism. He's acting like a text critic, editing his gospel to produce a, it's been corrupted, and he's editing his gospel to produce a better edition manuscript of the gospel.
Excellent. I think you meant I think you meant Marcion rather than Tatian, but otherwise, yeah. I think it's such an interesting article, and I recommend that to viewers and listeners as well. Okay, so that's the position that you're criticizing. Tell us what your position is briefly.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm arguing that they're wrong, that they failed to understand what ancient textual criticism is, and so misunderstood what Tertullian and Origen are up to when they characterize them as textual critics. What actually is going on, I argue, is Tertullian and Origen are placing Marcion into a category according to which he fails. This is explicitly not what scholars do. This is not what text critics do. Mm-hmm. And they invoke textual criticism. They call him an emendator precisely to deny that he is a gospel author. He's an evangelist. Mm-hmm. So we see in Irenaeus that this sort of rhetoric seems to be in the air. Tertullian says you should not think of him as a gospel author. He is a text critic. And of course, reading Tertullian, he's a terrible text critic. So that's the argument, I think. That's, I think, what Tertullian and Origen are up to, that they are trying to put him, make sure you think about him not as the author of a new gospel, but rather as a Hellenistic critic, precisely because he doesn't do what they should do.
Mm-hmm. I think it really makes sense. It's an excellent article. I want to recommend that again. The NT Review podcast has one fun element in that you pronounce it Tertullian, and Nate Tilly pronounces him Tertullian. And yes. I smiled while I was driving along listening to this the other day and hearing the differing pronunciations of the name.
I'm afraid I unabashedly Americanize lots of...
That's absolutely fine, and it's a real pleasure. I will put details of your podcast and of your book and of other things that we've talked about today in the show notes, just so that people want to check out people like Loveday Alexander, want to check out what on earth the Epistle of the Apostles is. Hopefully we've whetted people's appetites for a really fascinating area of discussion. But thank you once again for writing this great book, and thanks for joining me on the NT Pod. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much to Dr. Ian Mills for joining me today on the NT Pod. As a reminder, his book, The Hypothesis of the Gospels, Narrative Traditions in Hellenistic Reading Culture, is out now from Fortress Press. Don't forget his podcast, which he co-hosts, the NT Review, and you can find links to all of this stuff in the show notes. The NT Pod is produced by me, Mark Goodacre, and you can find it online at podacre.blogspot.com or on my YouTube channel, Podacre. It's great to have your company. Hope to see you again soon. Bye-bye.